my camera's on, we'll clap at the same time.
That's not even, no. We can't, we literally can't do that.
Okay. All right. I got a story for you, Jake. Or maybe I should have phrased it as a question that I pose.
Okay.
Did I say prose? That I pose to you?
You did say prose, yeah.
I'll prose it and pose it. All right. Jake, as a DM, this question is kind of a expanded version of a question from Reddit user Marbled Gummy. That reminds me of those, you know, those like gummies that have like the white streaks in them. I don't even know if it's a different flavor.
I don't even know what you're like, talking about.
His name is Marbled Gummy, like the gummy candies that have like the white that runs through them.
I've never seen that before in my entire life.
All right, get in the comments. People know what I'm talking about.
We've had different upbringings.
All right, fair enough. Get in the comments. They know what I'm talking about. So this Reddit user, Marbled Gummy, asks, what do you do when you mess up or reveal a player's secret?
Dude.
And I think that we can answer that, but also I would like to maybe broaden that out to just as a DM, like if you slip up and you give some information that you weren't planning to give away yet, or you give up a secret, what's your reaction? How do you handle that?
I think, as everybody would probably agree, the first thing you do is you shit your pants.
Immediate
defecation, straight into the
drawers. Scrolling through notes, like
yeah,
trying to like grasp the gravity of what just happened.
Yeah, and the thing is that like, you could do one of two things. You could try to play it off as if you like didn't say that, or the second option is you fucking immediately stop talking and then everyone knows. Everyone's like, he just revealed something you shouldn't have because he stopped talking. He's looking at his screen.
I like immediate gaslighting. I think as a DM in general, I think your poker face is important for sure. I think you do have to develop some level of poker face. I've found it's really hard. I know, like, especially when you have like a cool moment planned and you're just getting to it, and, like, you know that you're about to drop a line or a magic item or something that you're so excited for, like, you really gotta lock in.
Dude, my problem is I'm such a smiley person in conversation that, like, I'll be sitting, I'll like be in the middle of this cool scene, and then I'll just like, it's obvious that like, if you looked at me while DMing, you're like, that motherfucker is planning something, and he knows that it's gonna be interesting because he's got the biggest shit eating grin on his face right now.
I know,
because
I'm just stoked. Like I'm so excited for like, you know, whatever player it's happening to or the group or whatever, or especially like if a twist is coming up. Like if I know I'm about to reveal, so I guess this is good in line with the question, but if I know I'm about to like kind of drop a plot twist, like I like really got to lock in and kind of contain it. But okay, you're playing and you reveal a piece of information. Maybe it's a secret about a player, about their backstory. Maybe it's about the campaign at large. You reveal a secret.
It's pretty rough. It's pretty rough.
What would you do? What would the steps you take to kind of rectify that or handle it with the players to make it the most fun, I guess? Because that's always the best.
That's kind of hard because, like, I mean, my first, like, thought would be, like, okay, gauge the room. Did everyone actually hear what I just said?
True. Yeah,
then
that's
it becomes an if-then statement then.
Right, because it totally could just slip through, like, and nobody says anything.
Yeah,
and you might just be all right.
Yeah, I mean, if someone's like, if like a character's point is like, oh, this tattoo is gonna move across my body, and like I'm just like, oh, your tattoo moves, and then like everyone like sits there and pauses for a second, and looks at me, like, huh? I'm like, oh fuck, Jesus Christ, I didn't mean to do that at all. I mean, I'd probably just like roll with it, like. At some point, it's gonna happen, you know? If this person has a sentient tattoo and they wanted to keep it secret for some fucking reason, like this, I don't know why I run this bit, but.
I like it. It's a specific example. Could happen.
It's a specific example. If I let slip that their tattoo is sentient, starts talking or something,
not a bad idea. I don't think we've had
kind
that
of a cool game. One, yeah.
Kind of a cool thing.
I don't know if I'm a genius or the exact opposite, but that is one of my better ideas. But yeah, if you just drop it randomly, like, it's gonna come out at some point. So I think just roll with it. Like,
that's definitely a path. I think there's a couple of paths. I think just rolling with it is totally valid. I think just being like, all right, now you guys know, like, let's explore what that means. Also, I think that, you know, you can kind of delve into the idea that players sometimes know things that their characters don't, right? So if you really bomb something, like if you give away something that, like, really breaks the illusion or the immersion around some piece of the campaign or around a player, or maybe the player's just really boned, maybe they really wanted to reveal the secret and you slip up, I think you could be honest and say, oh, I just said that thing, and I really wanted to keep that a secret. So, you know, just remember that, you know, you, Jake, you know, do kind of know that, and we'll, you know, keep, put that in the back of your mind. But, you know, Ragnar the Barbarian or whatever doesn't know that. He doesn't, you know, he's not aware of that, which I think is okay. It's not probably the most satisfying thing in the world, but I do think that, you know, in a like-minded, level-headed group, I think that that's okay.
Yeah, I would say with our group, like, we could get away with doing that,
right?
Just being like, your character doesn't know what just what I guess. Yeah, that's
and I want to hope that anybody taking our advice is playing with a group of people they enjoy and trust. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's kind of always. Not always the case, but, you know, that's really all I can give advice for. Obviously, I'm sure we'll read some stories about some bad groups or bad DMs, but that's a whole separate issue. How do you feel about player secrets in general? Like, if somebody's making a player character, they're making their character and they have a secret in their backstory or some sort of secret, you know, identity, they're a changeling, they're a something, you know, like, just in general, they have some secret. How do you feel about that?
I probably am significantly different than most people because I, when I create my characters, I don't do a damn thing to create my characters, actually. I generally, my character creation process is as thus. I figure out what class I want to play. And I figure out a name and then maybe like a theme for the character, like what kind of person is it? And then that's it. I don't like, I really don't delve into like their background too much when I'm making a character. So like for me, like a player's secret doesn't exist because I don't even know.
But as a DM, if you're DMing for someone,
if someone else has, like, I mean, we've had lots of times where people have been like, okay, I've got this one thing and it's something that I keep to myself. I'm like, I'm going to be like, okay, cool. Like, it probably won't affect like the story at large, but when you bring it up, like, that's going to be like, that'll be cool for you, I guess.
Yeah. We've done a lot of player secrets or character secrets, player character secrets before. And I think at this point I'm starting to stray away from it. Cause I think, If you start a character that has some big secret, then there is X amount of sessions where you're not being completely genuine. Yeah, where you're not being completely genuine with that character or honest, big or small. And I think you're just holding yourself back from getting it fully into that character and getting fully invested in the group. I think one of the most important things when creating a character is you have to make somebody that wants to be in the adventuring group, you know, that wants to be there, that wants to save the world, be on the big mission, slay the dragon, and be friends with these people. I think if you're a more experienced player, you can pull back on some of those things. Maybe they don't know if they want to save the world, or maybe they don't know how they feel about these people, but you have to be very careful, because I think you will fall into a trap where you have a character that doesn't feel satisfying to play because either they don't want to be there or they don't like these people, and that's never fun, because then you feel like maybe you should switch characters, retire a character, maybe you are kind of waiting for this character to die. Like, you just, it's never good. You always want to be there, want to be involved, want to like the people around you. And honestly, the more I play, I think the quicker that happens, the more fun. Like, I think as soon as all the players in the group really like each other's characters. The characters like each other. They're very close. And they start opening up, you know, telling each other their backstories in game, you know, saying, oh, I come from this place, or I had this happen to me. I think that's where you get some of the best role play. You trust each other. You're invested in each other's characters. You care if something happens to them. And I think you should be trying to get there as quick as possible, even if it feels like, you know, oh, it's only session two and, you know, I'm revealing this information or being really close to these people. That's the game, man. I mean, you know, it's not real life where, you know, you have to be really slow to trust people or whatever, right? You can, you can expedite that to make the game more fun, I think, for sure.
Yeah. I like, we've had some games where, like, a player's secret is a pivotal plot point before. And I guess that's one way that you could, like, approach a player having a secret. But I don't think that, like, I don't think it works with parties that aren't very experienced, because it kind of, like, for a, at least for the moment of whatever the plot point is, that person is, like, 100% the spotlight, because they either knew, like, the secret that was happening, or like, something about something else that was happening in the world where everyone else didn't know. So, like, that kind of sucks a little bit, but in, like, in like, the same sense, like, it kind of sucks to, like, not be able to, because, like, between you and me, like, there's shit I don't tell you, we talk to each other multiple times a week, like,
right. Yeah, we're actual real-life best friends, and there's definitely stuff that we don't know about each other. You know, currently, historically, you know, if you put it in D&D terms, in our backgrounds versus, you know, like, there's definitely secrets we have from each other.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's secrets.
There's just things you don't share.
I'm sure there's things that we know about each other that no one else knows about each other, so.
Also true.
So, like, I guess it's kind of like a balance. It's like, where do you draw the line of, like, is like, a secret, like, too much to be hiding? Like, like, the changeling example. Like, it's cool to, like, be like, okay, yeah, my character's a changeling, but he's gonna, like, face as a Goliath, let's say. It's like, he's gonna pose himself as Goliath for this whole time. Like, that's a really cool, like, thing to base your character on. Like, changelings in D&D have, like, lore to them, obviously, and people don't like changelings, so that is something that, like, it would be a secret. But I think,
right,
like, as to what you said, when your party, like, gets to the point where they know they're gonna, like, vibe with each other, like, that reveal the secret, and that should be, like, early.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's the turning point that, like, oh, guys, I have something to tell you. And then you, like, reveal that part about you.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Is, like, being a changeling who is hiding their identity for some reason. And, you know, I think, you know, especially in a world where maybe people are distrustful of changelings because they're just, you know, kind of deceptive by nature, right? They can change their appearance. I think that could be a really cool secret to have, a secret to the world, right? You don't want to tell people you're a changeling. You want to hide your identity. But I don't think, like you said, it should necessarily be a secret to the party for very long. I think you should be looking for that opportunity to open up so that they understand your character, they understand your background, and then they're a part of the bit with you, right? They're a part of that, you know, kind of character arc of, like, okay, you have to hide your identity, you're whatever, you know.
Yeah, and like, for you can play an example together. That is more fun, I think, that you reveal yourself as a changeling to your party, and then now it's your party's problem that they have to make sure that you are hidden as a changeling. Like, that's a way cooler story beat than, oh, I'm constantly hiding from my party that I'm a changeling, and eventually it'll, like, come out. Or it's like,
yeah.
I mean, what if you go into combat in the city, you get knocked down? Like, I think as a changeling, if you go, if you're down, you turn back into your changeling form. So, like, what happens when you're in combat in the middle of town and you get knocked down and there's just changeling lying around? Like, oh, it's not everybody in the party is like, oh my god, a changeling, what happened to my friend? It's the party being like, holy shit, we need to fucking figure this shit out right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think having a party secret is more interesting than a character secret. But it's a collaborative game. It's a collaborative story that you're telling, and I think that when everybody's in on the secret, and you know, like you said, kind of it creates a problem for everybody. I think that's infinitely more interesting. To kind of cap this question off, I think that there's a very apt quote that comes from the Mistborn Brandon Sanderson fantasy series. Brandon Sanderson's the author. He wrote Mistborn, and one of the things from that book is there's always another secret. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very apt, right? You can, if you reveal a secret, you know, there's always another layer. There's always a, you know, a hidden meaning, a deeper meaning, right? So it's like it's a slip up doesn't always mean the end. You can always kind of flesh that out.
Yeah, I like that.
All right.
I've got one for you. I've got one that I would like to go over. All right. So there's a little backstory to this, and I think there's a couple of really good points to it. So this is from Inner Tomorrow 6301, my first DM experience. I just thought I'd share something funny that happened to me with my first DM experience. The party wakes up in a dark room and sees a landscape reminiscent of Great Plains from Breath of the Wild, and then they decide that they should have a picnic in order to get to the party members. The person making the food rolls a nat 1, so I say it's poisoned. The first player who eats a roll gets a nat 20, so I say the whole bowl gets unpoisoned from sheer willpower. Later, they're in a dungeon, and they've just finished fighting some orcs and decide to eat some food to heal, since that's how it works in video games. And the exact same thing happens. They roll a nat 1 and then a nat 20. The next room, they get over a pit of snakes, and three of them fell in, so they have to feel again. And you can guess what happens. The same thing, a nat 1 and a nat 20. These were the only nat 1s and nat 20s rolled in the entire game, and they all happened in the same way. I haven't been in DLM very long. Does this happen often? So, I mean, first of all, like, absurd situation. No. Yeah. That doesn't happen very often, but I think there's two beats that we can really hit on here. So I think the first one is, how do you feel about food healing in tabletop games?
It is very video gamey, but I do kind of like it, especially because in our experience in our games, like, nobody really keeps track of food. You know, sometimes when you go to a tavern, you know, you might describe the food and the drink that you get, but like, I'm never like checking in to be like, okay, well, have you guys eaten today? You know, like, I don't, some people might do that survival game aspect of it. Rations are cheap, you know, a couple sessions in, once you start making gold, it's really, you know, plausible that your players could buy rations as much as they wanted. So it's not something that I really like to keep very close track of, because it's just another thing that takes my attention from all the other stuff I have to do, which I don't think is super fun. So I do actually really like the idea of your players sitting down to eat, and then maybe that counts as a free short rest, or maybe even a free long rest if it's like a big feast meal picnic thing or something. I do think that's kind of fun, and I just like the role play potential of like the party sitting around eating together, you know, sharing stories, sharing drinks. Like, that sounds very fun to me, and it's a cool way to incentivize that with the healing kind of game mechanic.
I think that I take a much different stance than you. Okay. Let me hear it. Hate that this person made it so that food heals. I think it doesn't work in the context of, like, D&D especially. It does not work. There are already so many ways that you can heal in D&D that if you just like start with the rule that like, okay, if you eat a slice of bread, like, you're going to heal a little bit, that just like obfuscates having like health potions or doing short rests. I like the idea of like, maybe the food is like an incentivized like short rest, but then like at that point, just say you're taking a short rest and you're going to eat. You know what I mean?
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, I agree. It definitely can't just be like, oh, I have food in my pack, I eat it, and I'm have health, more health now. You know, like, I do think in my mind it is like a ritual thing where it's like, okay, you're going to take how much time to sit and eat, then maybe you get this much health back.
Yeah, and if you really want, like, food to, like, play some part in, like, healing, like, maybe they have to take a short rest. But, like, if they say, like, oh, I'm going to eat, like, rations or something, like, I don't know, throw in, like, a D6 or something. Like, all right.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, maybe you can get some bonus healing. Yeah, like, if you have some food, it's like, all right, your short rest, you know, you get access to your hit dice. And then maybe it's like, oh, you guys are eating, you got some food from that town or that dungeon, or you have some rations. Okay, then, yeah, everybody gets an extra D4, D6, D8, D10, depending on how the quality of rations. You know, if you have some, like, really fine elven wine and bread or something, maybe it's, like, a bigger dice. That could be interesting. There's some cool stuff there.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, I do think that this is a situation only applicable to D&D. Because I can't, maybe you could apply it to, like, Monster of the Week. You're like, oh, yeah, you get one harm back if you eat a sandwich.
Oh, yeah. I would have to. It's been a minute since we did. I don't remember the conditions to heal harm in Monster of the Week.
Yeah. Most of it is time based. So you have to, like, you gain, like, I think, you regain one harm a day, stuff like that.
Sure. I think if you find the idea of eating, drinking kind of attractive in your game, like, I think if that's something you want to keep track of, I do think there are fun and engaging ways to do it. I never want it to feel like a survival game where I'm like, oh, but have you guys eaten today? Like, otherwise you're going to have a debuff. You're going to have a -1 to all your rolls if you haven't eaten. And then your player's like, okay, well, I have a bread. You know, like, it's just, that's not fun to me. But I think, yeah, if you can incorporate in a way that's fun and, you know, makes short or long rests more interesting because your party sits together and eats, I think that's cool. I like that.
Dungeon World does an excellent job of like, rations. Where you, when you do your Take a Perilous Journey, you roll for rations, or
and then you slowly mark them off. Yeah, you have like 5 rations. You tally and you mark them off.
It's fast and it's impactful. So like if you have 0 rations, like, oh, I mean, eventually something bad is going to happen to you. Like,
yeah,
it's
easy to track because it's always 5. You can only ever have 5. So then it's like, you know, you mark it down, however many you take, you know, depending on how long the journey is, how many rolls you make, the outcome of the rolls, you're marking away your rations and you're eating and drinking. And then whenever you get back to a town, you can refill your rations and it just goes back up to 5. So it's fairly easy as well.
Yeah. I think it's a much more narrative, a lot less crunchy way of doing something that's a little bit more survival-y. It makes, like, kind of that feeling of having rations feel a little bit better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There was one other thing in this story that I want to talk about. Okay. In the beginning, he talks about that someone rolls a nat 1 when they go to eat the food, and so then all the food is poisoned. Which, so there's this interesting thing that happens, and I think this definitely applies to newer DMs. I definitely did this as a newer DM, where, like, nat 1s and nat 20s are reality warping, crazy, you know, things, and which can be very fun. There are moments where, like, a nat one going horribly wrong can be very funny, or nat 20 going so incredibly well can feel very awesome. You just have to, you'll get this with time. It's a skill that you develop, but you have to learn where exactly those fit. Every nat one cannot be the, you know, doom and gloom, worst thing, you know, you make a fool of your characters. And a nat 20 can't be this reality warping success every time either. Because, you know, this person said, how often does this happen? I don't know about nat 1s directly into nat 20s, but nat 1s and nat 20s, they do happen. They're going to come up all the time, right? And always in the most unexpected moments.
Yeah, that's literally the second prompt I have written down.
Yeah. And dice, so I think, like,
my prompt is, the dice are going to do exactly what you don't expect.
yeah, always, right? And so I think in that situation, maybe that initial nat 1 where this person's offering food, that could be an interesting nat 1. Is like, oh, you do realize that the food is poisoned. Or maybe they don't realize, I guess, because it's a nat 1. I don't know. you know, what other checks they made, but you as the DM know that this food is poisoned. I think that with the players nat 20, when they eat the food, I don't know if this was a group check or a singular person's check.
It says
but...
the first player to eat the to eat it rolls a nat 20, and so I okay, see the so whole this was a singular bowl gets unpoisoned.
Person. Yeah, so I would have in that situation said, you know, you take a bite of the food and you realize that this food is poisoned. Luckily for you, you know, in this moment, your constitution or your fortitude was, you know, so overpowering that you were able to resist this poison. It has no effect on you. You're so tough and strong and awesome, you know, because you do want to make your players
you're
feel good
so
about
tough
your
and strong and awesome.
Yeah. But I wouldn't say that the whole bowl of food is unpoisoned. That doesn't really make sense
to
me.
Yeah, that's a little crazy.
I think the goal with nat 1s and nat 20s, you know, with as I mentioned before, sometimes they should get crazy in the moments where it's going to be most fun or entertaining. But 90% of the time, I think nat 1s and 20s should stick to the rule of the worst or best possible outcome, you know, mm-hmm. within your player's abilities, right? So,
yeah.
You know, if you're like, I think a classic example is like you're playing a bard and you have a very high charisma and you roll a nat 20, right? Technically, rules as written, nat 20s are not an auto success in skill checks, only in attack rolls. Mm-hmm. But I think people often make them auto success anyways, which is fair. I mean,
yeah.
If you roll a nat 20 and you don't succeed, what was the point of rolling? You shouldn't have been rolling, right?
It's way cooler.
But like you're a bard, you have very high charisma, and you are talking to the king, and you roll a nat 20 persuasion check. The king does not take off his crown, lay it on your head, declare you the new emperor of, you know, Neverwinter, and go on his merry way to enjoy his new life as a peasant, right? Like, it's just, it's not satisfying, it doesn't make a lot of sense, like, you absolutely should, on a natural 20 persuasion check, maybe make a incredibly convincing argument to this king. You really pulled his heartstrings and you sway him in the direction to help your party or to do something that you're trying to convince him to do. Mm-hmm. But it should not be like, it's not a charm person. It's not a wish spell. You know, it's not like this reality warping, which I've used a couple times because it feels that way thing. And I think that that's a good lesson to learn. And then once you feel like you have a good handle on applying realistic, you know, kind of stakes for those nat 1s and those nat 20s, those worst case scenario and best case scenario within your player's abilities, then you start applying the fun, wacky ones. 'Cause it's a game. The goal is always, number one rule is have fun. And sometimes they're just too, like, damn funny or awesome, you know, with nat 1s and nat 20s respectively, that you just gotta go all out and you will learn when to do that.
See,
for sure.
And
that's
a skill you'll
develop.
I really used to have a problem as a DM where, like, if someone, like, it's in combat, if someone rolls a nat 1, I'd be like, well, what's worst case scenario? All right, you hit your teammate. I hated that. And, like, I did it all the time because I was like, well, like, I mean, there's gotta be, like, some punishment for doing that bad.
Sure.
Especially on, like, an attack like that. So, I mean, the options that, like, in my brain, I don't like doing this now. The options in my brain were always, like, hurt a teammate, lose your weapon, in whatever capacity that is.
Yeah, I think those are pretty classic, like, critical fails.
And, like, I think, like, for the most part, like, this is a, obviously, like, nat 20, nat 1 is so synonymous with D&D. Like, other games that we've played just don't have this problem.
Right. A lot of them don't use D20s.
Yeah,
you know,
most of them
don't
use
two D20s. 2D6s, 2D10s, you know, lots of other dice. Maybe they have special dice for a lot of the games, like Vampire the Masquerade. Well, I guess those are technically D10s.
They're technically D10s, but you have to, like, number them out.
Yeah. And they have specialized symbols on them, which you could use regular dice.
And like, in those games, there are, like, great successes and, like, catastrophic failures. And but there's, like, rules that happen when you get, like, a great success or catastrophic failure. Like, in Vampire the Masquerade, like, if you succeed, what is it? If you succeed too hard, you, like, lash out or something, right?
Yeah, the beastly instinct takes over. Yeah. It's like if you just go to tackle somebody, but you exceed, you know, there's like a bestial success, and then you could end up killing the guy. You know,
yeah,
you went too hard.
And like the same thing with like a catastrophic failure. Like I think in Vampire, you can like straight up lose your character. Like you lose control of your character, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can kind of go feral
so
for a moment. Or
this is like a problem that I think only happens in D&D, which is like. We are not D&D people, I would say, for the most part. We play Powered by the Apocalypse for most of our games anymore.
We used to be for close to
like six or seven years.
We only played 5th edition.
We didn't play another system until we played Monster of the Week. And we only played Monster of the Week because I don't even know where you found Monster of the Week. You just said, I found this really cool game and we have to play it.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you. Now, we've mentioned a couple of them. Dungeon World is another Powered by the Apocalypse, Vampire the Masquerade, Call of Cthulhu, Warhammer. We've done a bunch now.
And we only discovered Dungeon World last year.
Mm-hmm. And we've already done like 3 campaigns in it in a year. Yeah. Yeah. Something you said, you were talking about nat ones and, you know, throwing your weapon, losing your weapon, hitting a teammate. I think those are pretty classic critical fail roles. Something that I've adopted more, sometimes I think they're appropriate, something you always want to keep in mind is no player is going to have fun if, you know, they roll poorly, you know, which is going to happen, right? And the dice, you know, that's the dice decisions. The player didn't do anything. The player could have said something really cool. You know, I run up to the dragon, I leap into the air, you know, and with 2 hands on my axe, I slam it down into the dragon's head and, oh, nat one, right? Like, and that feels bad. And then if you take that and you go, the axe flies out of your hand and you land in dog shit and you slip and bonk your head and there's dog shit on your face. Like,
and your head is bonked.
As a player, it feels so bad. Like, you just, like, no one wants to be made out to be the idiot or the fool, especially when they felt like they were going to have a really cool character moment, right?
Yeah, I think you can fall in dog shit on like a like on a role that doesn't matter if like someone just like I hit it with my sword.
Yeah, like, it just depends, right? No one wants to be made the fool, and so you should be a little sensitive of those nat ones. Something that I've found that is more interesting is especially if they're like attacking an enemy and they roll a nat one, then, you know, it becomes a, you know, not only do you whiff this attack, they dodge out of the way. This enemy is much faster than you anticipated. They look at you and, you know, and you see a smile kind of creep onto their face. It's like, oh, so now, you know, you've kind of built up the enemy. They're faster than the player thought. You know, maybe they underestimated them. There's a little bit of tension there. Now this player maybe has a special kind of vendetta against this enemy. They smiled at him. They laughed at him. You know, you can build up that narrative and that story. And now it's like, now the player really wants to get him, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than just making them look like an idiot and a fool.
Yeah. The last time we played, the last time I DM'd D&D, I like the random tables. Like, I think they're just like a really fun way to like spice up your game a little bit. And like things that happen in those random tables are things that you would never think of as a DM, which just leads to some cool situations. So I tried to make like a nat 1 and a nat 20 like random table. Like, these are the things that could happen. And you basically if you get like a nat 1, like we never ended up doing it because we stopped playing this campaign. Either I would roll or the player would roll, and whatever happened on the table. I think some of the things were like if you rolled a nat one, like the enemy gets insight on you, they have advantage on their next roll against you, or if you got a nat 20, you gain some sort of insight on the enemy, you gain advantage on the next roll, or like
there's some extra little effects.
Yeah, you could fall prone
either way,
lose your sword. If you succeeded too hard, you can knock an enemy. If you got nat 20, knock an enemy prone, disarm them. Yeah. Like, it was things like that. And I thought it was going to be like a really cool way, because like that campaign, especially, we were rolling terribly, a lot of nat ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like when I like realized that I was on that one's making people hit each other too much.
Yeah.
So I just, yeah, that was
the, the bonus effects can be fun, but it is, I mean, yeah, but then you will fall into that thing of not ones are going to feel extra bad, right? There's an extra effect as well. So yeah, it's definitely a skill that you will develop and balance. And you know, everybody's going to have different takes on it. Some people will want to play where nat 20s, you know, have this reality warping effect. I remember one time we were playing D&D in, I mean, it must have been middle school. We were young. And one of our friends, just out of nowhere, just said, I want to summon Cthulhu, right? Cthulhu had not been established. There was no eldritch themes to this campaign. They were just in a dungeon fighting goblins. And this guy just said, I want to summon Cthulhu. And he rolls the dice and gets a nat 20. And he's like, I do it. I did it.
I did.
And I think I just... I think I described kind of this psychic event that happened to him, and he saw visions of this great old one, and I kind of set up maybe some potential for him to maybe have this warlock patron or something now. You know, I don't know what class he was playing, but maybe he could have gone, dipped into warlock and had this thing. I thought that, you know, if he wants to do something crazy, sure, let's explore this path. And then he was upset. He was upset that I didn't genuinely allow him then and there to just summon Cthulhu, right?
Yeah.
And some people might want to play like that. So, you know, always communicate with your group, with your players. What do they like? What's the most fun for them? It's going to vary group to group. Number one rule is just always have the most fun possible. That's why we play these games. We get together in person or online, and everybody should be laughing, having a good time. DM players included. Everybody should have fun, and that's always the goal.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. Summon Cthulhu when you want to. Sometimes it doesn't. Yeah,
sometimes
Cthulhu.
It's fun.
Sometimes it's fun.
Do you remember talking about nat ones, nat 20s? Do you remember one time we had like a rogue, and we were at some party or at some dinner, and they wanted to roll a stealth check. I keep saying they. It might have been me. I don't remember. They rolled a stealth check and they fit into a small bowl of nacho cheese sauce to hide.
Okay, that was this is when we did a Dungeon Crawl Classic. This was like one of the first times we ever played. I know whose character it was, we were in like this cave and there's a fountain or something, and they're like, oh my god, I need to hide. They rolled a nat 20, and then you were just like, where do you hide? And then he was like, I turn into liquid and melt in the vase or something.
Yeah, there was something about nacho cheese sauce. I don't remember how or why.
Yeah,
that's definitely not in the Dungeon Crawl Classic book.
No, definitely not in the book. Classic,
that we were in sixth grade at the time, so you know,
yeah, that
crazy things happened.
That was from one of the Dungeon Crawl Classics we played, and I think I remember which one because I think it was our second one because I think it was my second character.
Yeah.
My second barbarian, because my first two were barbarians.
One of these episodes, we're gonna have to reminisce about some characters we've played and tell the people, you know, what some of our experience in the 10 years we've been playing. Yeah. But
dude, you've got way less because you're such a forever DM. But like,
yes,
I've got some. I've got a handful, whereas you probably have.
Maybe you can say your favorite characters. I'll mention one or two of mine, and then maybe I'll pick some other ones from people we've played with and kind of give a mention of some characters that I like from them.
Dude, hell yeah. I'm so about that.
All right. So be on the lookout for that. I think this has been a really fun episode. We answered some interesting questions, talked about player secrets, campaign secrets, slipping up as a DM, nat ones, nat 20s, and all the in-between. So I've been Keegan, the forever DM, as Jake said, and this has been Jake, the storyteller. I think which is fitting. Everybody's telling a story at D&D. And check out our other podcast, The Northwood Project. We're working on that. That one's a little bit slower. It's a fictional story
horror
podcast. We're writing it. Yeah, horror anthology. If you're into that, if you've ever listened to the Magnus Archives, anything like that, you'll like it. So go check that out. And yeah, this has been the Gelatinous Dudes, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.